The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Not all of our guests have experience improvising on a radio interview, but we recently spoke to one who is a master behind the scenes.
All right.
Okay, so we have a brief introduction here. Maureen, you have the tape ready?
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have the tape.
Okay, right. So we have a little bit of tape in the intro of, you know, I'm wearing glasses, This American Life. That was my best. That was my best
was
imitation
really
of you.
That was good. I like how it's almost like mumbling. That's what I got. It's like, oh, that's my performance style. I mumble. It's totally true. That was totally real. I totally bought that. We should just run this. Please run this instead
yes,
of using
exactly.
the clip.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah. Okay. Wait. Hold. Let's pause. Okay. Run the clip now.
Hey, everybody. Ira Glass here. So we got this email at our radio show near the end of the last school year from a 14-year-old.
Hello?
Hey, is this Annie?
Yeah.
I called her up at her house in California and asked her to read it.
Okay, we're back from the clip.
For the past 20 years, Ira Glass has captivated audiences with his radio show, This American Life, which just won another Peabody Award. For those in public media and beyond, Glass is a trailblazer, credited with breathing new life into audio storytelling. He's done television, videos, movies, had a cameo on The Simpsons, but can he dance? Well, you'll be the judge this Saturday when he brings his live show, 3 acts, 2 dancers, 1 radio host to the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Ira Glass, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be here.
I was at the Music Hall, I guess about a month ago, for The Moth when they announced that Ira Glass was coming to town, and I heard an audible gasp in the audience. So people clearly know you.
A gasp like I'm returning to the scene of a murder? Like, what? He dares show his face here again?
Yes, that's how we all talk in New Hampshire, you know.
Exactly. I don't know where that accent came from. I'm so sorry. But like, I like it was like a gasp and then like, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, that happened. That happened. Yeah, the totally. Kettle drums yeah. were there. But nobody, I mean, I think people were wondering, like, Ira Glass, what can people expect to see on this show on Saturday?
It's a very hard to describe show, but the basics are it's me. There's 2 dancers and they dance and I tell stories and it's funny. It's gets very emotional and it's a real like show like there's costume changes and all kinds of stuff happens. And we've been touring with it now for 2.5 years. And this is like one of the last stops we're making. Actually, we're doing it only like once a month now. And the tour ends in July at the Sydney Opera House.
Wow.
Yeah, which is a dream I didn't even know I had until it was offered to me. And then I was like, yes, we are totally doing our dance show at the Sydney Opera House. And it's a show where I think people come in. I mean, I know for sure because I've talked to people. They come in really unsure what it's going to be, a show combining radio stories and dance. And I feel like there comes a turning point around 15 or 20 minutes into the show, and it's always exactly the same moment in the show where I feel like we do a thing on stage, and I feel like the audience just relaxes of like, okay, this is going to be fine. Hmm. And up until then, there's kind of like a question mark hanging over our heads of like, what did we pay for? And then people are like, oh, okay, yeah, all right, fine.
Well, it's not as something we think of, you know, storytelling and dance. So where did this whole idea, this collaboration with the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company even come from?
It came from me seeing them perform. I saw them perform, and I had met Monica once before, the choreographer, and I went to see her show. Like, you know, I met her at, like doing like a little thing on stage in Brooklyn, and then I was like, oh, come see one of your shows, and I went and saw her show. And honestly, I've never had this feeling at a dance show where watching her show, I felt like, oh, this is exactly the feeling that this show gives me is exactly the feeling I'm trying to give people with This American Life. Hmm. Like, exactly. And I just thought, like, if I could get their work in front of our audience, I thought our audience would really like them. And the similarities are these, that like they're entertainers, like they're out for fun, they're funny and it's emotional. And then there's a part of what they're doing, which is really just documenting real feelings that you have all the time and situations, and it's very character-based kind of dancing. And you find yourself watching their faces a lot. Like, they're very good actresses in addition to being amazing dancers.
That's funny. I remember just one of those, you know, I don't have a lot of dance vocabulary, but a quote that I read once from Martha Graham was that the body says what words cannot. And I wondered about that. You know, what are they adding? Are they adding something to the stories? Are they bringing something new to the stories? What's happening?
I mean, it's almost like the way that music functions on the radio show, where music gives momentum and feeling to the stories that we're telling with words. That's what the dance does in this case. And often what they're doing is that they're telling a second story. That is, I'll tell one story in words and they'll tell a different story in movement. And because we found if they were just illustrating what they were doing, if they were just illustrating what I was saying, it was a little bit corny. If that makes sense, like there's like, to give you an example, like one of the pieces that we have is we have the poet Donald Hall reading this incredibly beautiful passage from the book that he wrote when his wife died,
Jane Kennedy.
And this is a piece that we ran on the radio show years ago, and it's just about like taking care of her in the last days of her life, and I'm interviewing him and he's reading passages and talking about it, and it's set to music, and the two of them during that are doing a piece where they are standing, they're in house coats, and they're standing on top of a dining room table, and they do a very slow, intimate dance, holding each other on top of this table. And it's just like, it's just beautiful. And so they're not illustrating what he's saying, but they're providing a second thing with just as much feeling that sort of talks to it, if that makes sense.
It does. We haven't really talked about the dancers, though. Who are they?
Well, the dancers are Monica, the choreographer, and then her longtime partner, Anna Bass, and they are the dancers.
Do you dance in the show?
I don't discuss that publicly. when I say to reporters, as a fellow reporter, you're free to discuss this if you wish. I feel like it's kind of a spoiler. So I say nothing about that question.
Well, I wondered if when you were a kid, you know, you went and watched Broadway shows or saw dance performances and thought, oh, I would love to do that when I grow up.
When I was a kid, I saw many, many Broadway shows, and I never had any ambition to be one of the dancers. No. like who I wanted to be was the star of the show.
Somehow that
and
makes
like,
sense.
Yeah, but that somehow, like, that's a dream that never came true. I, you know, someone else is playing Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof right now on Broadway and not me.
But you were also in Yoko Ono's video, Bad Dancer, right? This is not your first rodeo, as they say.
Yes, yeah. Well, I got a very random call from somebody who said they worked with Yoko Ono, and she's sort of like, Yoko Ono is doing a video for her new record. Do you want to be one of the bad dancers in this video? And I was like, I believe that the level of my dancing can live up to that. And in a wedding and stuff, I'm an enthusiastic but not good dancer.
I actually read that there was no dancing at your own wedding.
That's correct. Yeah, no dancing. I'm surprised that somebody would have written about that. But yeah, no, there was no dancing at my wedding. No, there was like a lovely meal and drinks and no dancing at all.
How many times have you been engrossed by a story on This American Life and thought, it'd be so much better with dancers? Well, Ira Glass will be at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Saturday with his stage show, 3 acts, 2 dancers, 1 host. So you can see it all for yourself. Now, Ira, you've been doing the show now for 2.5 years, so do dance people come, or is it people who just want to see Ira Glass?
That's been one of the interesting things, is that most of the audience is people who are not people who usually go to dance shows. And I think that one of the things that people discover is, like, people have the feeling of, like, oh, I kind of like dance. Dance is pretty good. Like, because it's really an accessible show. Like, it's not like a modern dance show where you're just like, I don't know what that was about. You totally know what it's all about. And so I think one of the things that hardcore dancers have said, and people in the dance community have said, is like, it's nice for there to be a dance show that non-dance people come to. And Monica, the choreographer and the one who runs the Monica Bo Barnes Dance Company, like her ambition was that they were a successful dance company. They are a successful dance company, and they play the Joyce and they play Kennedy Center. But they're not like a company that random people go to. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. they've been around for years. They play all over the place. They make their livings as dancers. But she always had a feeling of like there's something about our work that she just felt like if a broader audience could see it, she thought that they would like it. And when I saw them, that was my instinct too. It was like, oh, this is something, this is like a mass market product that the mass market has not discovered what they do.
And you also said it was funny. I'm trying to think of dance productions I've been to that have been funny.
Yeah, yeah. Usually because dance, you know, goes for gorgeous. You know, like mm-hmm. like, you know, it's an art form where you can achieve gorgeousness in a way. And these dancers generally don't shoot for that. What they're shooting for is something way smaller and more human.
Oh, that's something that I think so many people associate with what you do. A lot of people, myself included, just there's this kind of intimacy. You feel like somebody is speaking exactly to you, you know, to one person in a car, to you with your earbuds on. And I'm wondering how that experience compares for you to this live experience when you have a big audience responding in real time. You know, they applaud. You don't get applause in a studio.
No, it's nice actually being in the room with the people who you're entertaining. Like it's weird. It's weird being on the radio. It's weird. It's weird going and performing your lines. And like I'm sitting right now as I talk to you at the microphone where I do the show from. And like it's weird to sit down with a script and then just, you know, record my lines, you know, just pretending that I'm talking to people and sort of with some sort of weird act of faith. And it's way harder, truthfully, than going out on a stage and talking to people who are actually there in the room, even after all these years of doing radio. So, no, that's one of the things about it that's really fun is being in the room with the audience. And then theater has an intimacy to it, too, that's a lot like the intimacy of radio, like the fact that you are in the room together.
Is that why you reached for this or started doing the live shows? I mean, you've been hosting This American Life for 20 years. It must be, I don't know, invigorating. It must be enlivening to try a new experience.
I'm always looking to do something new. Like, I always am. Like, and we do a lot of, we're constantly experimenting with stuff, including, like, the podcast Serial, but including, like, an animated cover we did for the New Yorker magazine a couple months ago. Including we just premiered a new movie at the Tribeca Film Festival that I produced and was heavily involved in making that Mike Birbiglia did. And so the dance show, like, honestly, it just seemed like it would be fun. Like, I don't have a sophisticated reason for doing it. It just seemed like once we started working on it, it seemed like, oh, this could be a really nice show and it would be fun to try. And honestly, like, one of the things that I didn't anticipate was what it would be like to tour a show. Like, we've never played the show in, I think we've played it in over 50 cities. I've never been in a show like that, like where you go out like, you know, like the cast of like a Broadway show and you do the same show every night.
I'm thinking about, you know, how many radio shows are now doing live on stage as This American Life, I believe, has modeled, you know, the iHeart Radio Festival at BAM. There's Radiotopia. Radiolab does live shows. And people want to come out and see radio or maybe radio stars, which you've been a really big part of. And I wondered if that, you know, as you were building your career, as you were building this audience, if you ever thought, you know, people were saying to you, well, radio's dead. I mean, that's not very interesting anymore. You know, you should be doing something like this. If there's a part of you that thinks, okay, radio's having a great day.
Well, people have been saying radio's dead since like 1950. So that never seemed like a factor to me at all. Like, I never even gave it a thought of, like, whether that was to be taken seriously. It seemed like, well, no, you can still reach people over the radio. And, in fact, like, millions of them. And then the theater part, it's weird how live performance is now the cutting edge of everything. Like, weirdly, the more that we're isolated from each other, you know, with all the stuff we download, the more hungry most of us are to actually get into a room with other people who like the same thing and see a live event. Like Lou Reed used to say, like people want to witness the body or people want to like stare at the body. He had some saying like that. And I feel like that there's really a thing to it. And I think that in a way, because all these shows are podcasts, it's a logical compliment that they would go out and do live shows, because as fans of the shows, like I've been to the Radio Lab live shows and they're incredible. They're really beautiful and incredible and different from the radio show, but kind of part of the radio show. And I totally understand why a fan of any show would want to go and be in person. And it's nice to be in a room with other people who like the same thing. It's a primitive thing.
Well, we can't wait to do that this weekend. Ira, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life. His live collaboration with the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company, three acts, two dancers, one host, is at the Music Hall in Portsmouth this Saturday. Tickets and information at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm a bad dancer, a busy bouncer. Never touch the ground, never make a sound. And when we come back, some other counterintuitive stages for dance, gas stations, street corners, and at the car wash. The origin story of inflatable tube men when Word of Mouth continues. I'm a bad dancer with no regrets. Come on, face your best. Watch your step. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We just spoke to Ira Glass about his unorthodox dance show, three acts, two dancers, one radio host, and now to dance of a different kind. This story comes to us from Roman Mars.
This is 99% Invisible. You see them on street corners, at gas stations, at shopping malls. You see them at blowout sales and grand openings of all kinds.
Their bodies flop. They flail.
They are men.
Men made of tubes. Tubes full of air.
Producer Sam Greenspan is full of more than hot air.
You know these things. A vinyl column perched on top of a fan with skinny little arms and a big dumb grin, blowing around goofily on a street corner near you.
They are either full of ridiculous, joyful exuberance or the tackiest thing in the world, depending on your tastes.
I want you to go ahead and try to imagine an origin story for these things. Used car salesman buys some tarp and a leaf blower and messes around in his garage? No. Bounce house designer goes rogue? No. The real story behind these is so much better. And it all starts with this guy.
I am Peter Minshall.
Peter Minshall, ladies and gentlemen. Renowned Caribbean artist who could easily have a second career narrating nature documentaries for PBS.
I'm an artist stroke mass man. This is a word indigenous to Trinidad, which is where I'm talking to you from now.
In Trinidad and Tobago, a mass man is someone who works in the carnival arts tradition.
Peter Minshall made a name for himself, in part, by making these larger-than-life puppets that dance through the street to the beat of a steel drum band.
His work was featured in a book called Caribbean Festival Arts, which wound up in front of someone on the steering committee for the Olympics. Which is how, in 1995, Peter Minshall found himself trying to figure out ideas for the opening ceremonies at the Atlanta Games the following year. As Minshall tells it, he was trying to do something using inflatable tubes.
I just sketched two of the inflatable tubes and joined them at the waist, going into one tube, which is a torso, and divided them again at the top with some arms and a bit of a head. You might get an incredible, undulating, dancing figure.
Boom. The dancing tube guys are born.
For short, let's call them tall boys.
Minshall realized that these tall boys, made from a tube hooked on an air source, would dance just like the people did back home in Trinidad and Tobago.
Peter Minshall knew how to make giant figures, but they had always been powered by people, not air. He knew he needed help.
And I got a call from the Olympic Games from Peter Minshall, and he asked me if I can create a human shape. And I told him yes.
This is Doron Gazit, another artist.
And if there's one guy who knows about making things full of air, it's him.
Gazit and his team headed over to meet Minshall and see if they could make the tall boys a reality, which actually turned out to be a pretty big engineering challenge.
I had to find the right strong, powerful motor that will be able to give me enough CFM and the right torque.
You get the idea. Engineering, physics.
Gazit futzed around with the materials and the methodologies. These tall boys came to life. The 1996 Olympics in Atlanta came and went. Doron Gazit was awarded a patent for apparatus and method for providing inflated undulating figures in 2001.
Gazit founded a company called Air Dimensional Designs, which basically serves to populate the world with his inflatable objects and sculptures.
Even though Minshall's not making any money off of these things, there doesn't seem to be any bitterness on his part. He loves seeing the tube guys around.
Could you imagine how I feel when I'm driving down. I don't drive, actually. When a friend is driving me down from a house in town to where we to a factory building place in Chagaramas, and I see a sort of diminutive version of a tall boy dancing up a storm by a gas station. I thought, my God, look at where we reach. And I'm suddenly aware that they're dancing up over gas stations all over the planet. A part of me can't help but feel delight that, goodness, little fella, look at what you and your island have given to the world.
The tube guys, the tall boys, they won't convince me to buy a new car anytime soon, but I will delight in seeing them try. And when I look upon them, I will know to listen for the distant whisper of a calypso band.
And our thanks to Roman Mars and 99% Invisible for that story. Up next, you think election 2016 is gonzo? Well, after the break, we'll hear about the ultimate outsider candidate, writer and journalist Hunter S. Thompson, who once ran for sheriff in Aspen, Colorado. That's when word of mouth continues.
All alone he was left to grieve. She had an ex-man in South. She said, oh, bully. She say, I really love you, Johnny. But you ain't have no money. So what will my future be, even though you say you love me?
Big yam, love without money.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in the late 1960s, Aspen, Colorado was booming. Its beautiful scenery and top-notch skiing made it a plum destination for wealthy tourists and a draw for hippies and ski bums. The tourists were welcomed with open arms. The hippies, not so much. The county sheriff cracked down on the unmoneyed newcomers, arresting them for minor crimes like loitering or hitchhiking. It was a move that inspired one of the most anti-establishment candidates in American history. Producer Nina Ernest from Backstory with the American History Guys brings us more.
Hunter S. Thompson had been living in Aspen for a few years when he
decided to run for sheriff to protect the hippies.
This is D.J. Watkins, who wrote a book about Thompson's 1970 campaign. He says that the writer ran for sheriff of Pitkin County under the banner of freak power.
We, long hairs, were labeled freaks by the establishment, and Hunter decided that freak was very descriptive. Let's use it.
And this is Bob Broaddus. He moved to Aspen to be a ski bum and soon found himself drawn to Thompson's campaign.
And I pretty much agreed with Hunter's platform, which was largely anti-greed and anti-chicken misdemeanor and felony laws.
What Broaddus means is that Thompson wanted to decriminalize drugs, limit development, and protect the environment. And Watkins says that Thompson also wanted to make the sheriff more than just a sheriff.
He wanted to embrace the idea of the ombudsman. There could be a member of government that his whole job was taking complaints from members of the community, sort of a watchdog of the government itself.
It sounds straightforward on paper, but some of his suggestions were a little surreal. Take this campaign advertisement.
Hunter represents something wholly alien to the other candidates for sheriff. Ideas. And a sympathy towards the young, generous, grass-oriented society which is making the only serious effort to face the technological nightmare we have created.
He wanted to tear up all the roads to make the city more walkable. He wanted to shame bad drug dealers, as in people who took advantage of their customers in public stocks, medieval style. And he wanted to change the name Aspen to Fat City to make the town less attractive to tourists. Thompson set out to enlist all the newly arrived hippies to vote for the freak power cause. Volunteers like Bob Broaddus registered over 700 new voters, a huge number for a county of just 6,000. Their success alarmed the town's more conservative residents, and Thompson's characteristically outlandish behavior didn't help. Here's Thompson himself.
We do have a freak power base, and that's undeniable. If I went out there and walked through the streets naked with a bomb in each hand, and drugs dripping, you know, covered with the various sticky substances that were known to be foul drugs, they would still vote for me.
Thompson's main opponent, who he called a dim-witted cowboy with a gun, was the incumbent Carol Whitmire. If Thompson was some bizarro version of a Western sheriff, Whitmire was straight out of Central Casting.
He had his honorary posse with white Stetsons, white kerchiefs, white shirts, white guns, and he was basically parading what I saw in Western movies in the 1950s. The good guys all wear white.
The American sheriff's job was carved out of the rugged West. Vote for and elect Carol Whitmire for our sheriff.
I think he woke up one day with Hunter running against him going, what the hell just happened?
Before long, this tiny local election became a national story. In October, Thompson wrote an article about his campaign for Rolling Stone magazine. After the Battle of Aspen hit newsstands, profiles on Thompson for sheriff appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post. Even the BBC made a documentary about this election.
What kind of sheriff do they want in the West these days? Could the conventional establishment citizens of Aspen elect as their sheriff a hippie, a freak, an acid head, a man who openly smokes grass, marijuana?
The battle lines were drawn. Here was a microcosm of the country's culture wars set amidst the ski slopes of Aspen. As the election approached, some of Aspen's residents began to worry that Thompson could actually win. So local elites ramped up their anti-Thompson rhetoric. They tapped into an issue that dogged his entire campaign. No one could figure out if he really wanted the job. While Broaddus thinks his friend was serious.
There was perhaps a component of self-aggrandizement, self-promotion in Hunter's run for sheriff, because it definitely attracted way more attention than we thought it would. One time where Hunter had embarrassed himself by one of his crazy actions, I said, Hunter, why are you doing this? And he said, Bob, you know I don't do crazy stuff unless I can write about it and get paid for it.
And running for sheriff, he told Broaddus, was the craziest thing he had ever done. Election day arrived, November 3rd, 1970. Reporters from across the country descended upon Aspen.
We were all watching the county clerk put the numbers up with chalk on a blackboard. And I was never as optimistic as some of the other people, but some people actually thought we were going to win.
We won! We won! We won!
Actually, Carol Whitmire won, but not by much.
The freak campaign had failed. The sheriff won by only 400 votes, though, out of 2,500.
That night, Thompson heard the news at a local hotel that doubled as campaign headquarters. Wearing a blonde wig and draped in an American flag, the losing candidate faced a gaggle of reporters.
I think I unfortunately proved what I set out to prove. And it was more a political point than a local election. And I think the original reason was to prove it to myself that the American dream really is.
Thompson never ran for office again, though he remained a lifelong resident of Aspen. And despite his loss, Watkins says that freak power lived on in this corner of the Rockies.
That voting block that he helped get involved and get engaged had a real lasting impact on every subsequent election.
Look no further than the sheriff's office. Here's how it happened. Carol Whitmire left office amidst allegations of mismanagement, and the guy that was elected after him had been Thompson's choice for his undersheriff. And the next sheriff of Pitkin County? Thompson's friend, Bob Broaddus.
I've been retired for 5 years after 24 years as sheriff.
Broaddus says that he and his fellow sheriffs worked hard to make Hunter's platform a reality, especially his idea that the sheriff should be more of a problem solver than a strict law enforcer. On the other hand, Aspen never became Fat City and is in fact glitzier than ever. Still, Watkins claims that Aspen's progressivism is worth emulating.
You know, these things that Hunter was writing about and that Aspen went through are actually a model for what other places around the country are going through.
But some people are going to hear this and say, okay, this works for Aspen, But Aspen is a small town. It's a very wealthy town. It's not very diverse. So what could this really tell us about how law enforcement can change?
Well, in Aspen, 1970 is not so different than some other places now. But yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. I mean, we live in sort of a bubble here.
But as Tip O'Neill said, all politics are local. And Hunter Thompson said, politics is the art of controlling your own environment. So you start small. If it spreads beyond your city limits, so be it. But if you've controlled your own environment, you've won.
And that story was produced by Nina Ernest. You can hear more from Backstory with the American History Guys. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Death, like life, rarely plays out the way it does in fiction, or especially the movies, where a character's last moments on Earth are often accompanied by poignant words of resolution and catharsis, and absolution sought or granted. The writer Katie Royfe regrets not pressing for that last conversation before her father died, and many of her friends and colleagues shared that fantasy. Now she's out with a book on the final days of some influential writers and thinkers, including Susan Sontag, John Updike, and Dylan Thomas. It's called The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End. I spoke with Katie Royfe about a related op-ed she wrote for The New York Times, which reflected on that shared fantasy of the last conversation, one that she never had.
My father died very suddenly of a heart attack, and he was 82, but he was healthy, walking to work. He was a doctor, seeing patients all day, so it was kind of a shock, and it was very sudden. So I never got to have kind of a last conversation with him.
Did you play out what that fantasy conversation would sound like with him in your head?
Well, I didn't have one of the kind of complicated relationships some people have, and we had a pretty straightforward, very strong relationship, but I still felt like when he died, he was very worried about my marriage. I was in the process of leaving my husband, but he didn't know that yet, and he was kind of worried that my daughter and I were going to live in, you know, misery. And so I wish that I'd been able to tell him that my husband was leaving, and I was kind of about to, but I didn't bring myself to have that conversation. And there was also questions about his life that I would have wanted to ask him.
So is that what set you on this road to write about writers' final days?
Well, I think so. I also was very, very ill as a child. So when I was 12, I almost died of this lung condition I had. And so that's when I started thinking about it. And then when my father died, it kind of reignited this topic in my head. And I found when I was researching the book, because I was writing about, you know, these writers' deaths, and, you know, I was talking to children and wives and ex-wives and friends, and I found that this fantasy of having a last conversation was much more common than I realized, that everybody sort of imagined this moment, this sort of perfect ending, this conversation where you ask all the questions that you meant to ask, or, you know, you sort of forgave the person for things they've done. And what I found in talking to people was that so many people felt, even when their parents died a kind of long, drawn-out death, that they didn't have that conversation.
Why not? Why don't we have it if we want to so much?
I know, it's really strange. I think that the idea that this moment of extremis where somebody is dying is going to kind of clarify everything, and they're suddenly going to be transformed into this person who sees things really clearly and is really generous and suddenly can talk about the things that they've been unable to talk about, and all the reticence will fall away. We have that idea that death kind of clarifies everything, and I actually think it doesn't. This is something I learned in writing about the writers for my book. You just don't turn into a different person. Mm. At the end, usually. And one of the writers I wrote about, Updike, he wrote about how he saw an unaskable question. One of his characters saw an unaskable question on his son's face as he was dying. And it's like most of those topics you want to talk about are sort of too big to put into words.
Mm. That was in Rabbit at Rest, I think, that the words enough, maybe enough, last words.
Exactly.
So he was working out something, obviously. Do you think he wanted to have that last conversation, too?
Well, it's interesting because I talked to his ex-wife, and she had mentioned that she had questions for the real Updike, that she didn't get to have that conversation. She thought she was going to see him another time, and she didn't, and she didn't feel like she could raise the issue that he was dying with him, and she felt like she had these questions that only he could answer. And I just heard that over and over from sons and daughters and sort of friends, that they had these questions. And, you know, in the end, and I felt that way with my father, you know, I had these questions I wanted to ask him, like, did he think his mother fell out a window or committed suicide?
Whoa.
What did he feel like in the Battle of the Bulge? He fought in World War II. These are subjects he never, ever talked about. And I think if I'd actually, you know, I kind of have this fantasy, this sort of reporter's fantasy that I'm going to interview him and he would have answered. But, you know, in the end, I think he wouldn't have. And I think he probably would have deflected those questions the same way he would have in the rest of his life. He was not someone who talked about himself. He was kind of more silent and stoic. And I think he would have been that way had I asked him those questions.
Yeah, I had a similar fantasy with my dad that, you know, I'd bring out the tape recorder. But I did end up getting a really nice recording of him singing Old Danny Boy.
Oh, that's nice.
It was beautiful. But I mean, writers, those are people we turn to for interpreting relationships, for cutting through all the window dressing. Or I think Susan Sontag, one of the people that you profile, wrote about, you know, getting beyond the shiny surface. So do they get there? Are they able to have these conversations in their final days?
Well, that's kind of one of the things that I explored in the book, and largely they did not. I wanted to write about writers because I wanted people who could put the confrontation with death, and by that, you know, their own deaths, into words. It's something that we find very hard to talk about and very hard to imagine. And I found that they sometimes did, but what they didn't necessarily do, and obviously writers are not known for being like the best human beings on earth. And so many of them had been really difficult parents to have or difficult spouses, but they didn't necessarily end their human relationships on such a great note, not all of them.
But yet wrote about death, you know, like in the case of John Updike that you mentioned, and Susan Sontag, certainly. So is there a big gap between, you know, the person and the way that they communicated their thoughts about death?
Yeah, I think that the way that and one of the things that was interesting to me about Sontag is just that in her writing, she is so committed to being rational. She wrote Illness as Metaphor, and the whole idea was, you know, kind of, you know, facing your illness without fantasy, without metaphor, without letting your imagination go wild, and being really logical. And she wrote a sort of that urgent, gorgeous book about that imperative. And yet in her own life, she was unable to do that finally at the end. And she really suffered a lot in her death because she believed that she would be the exception. She had this idea that she wasn't dying, even when it was so clear that she was unable to admit that to herself or to kind of think about that, which caused her to seek out these treatments at a point at which she, you know, it arguably seemed to those around her like it might have been a more peaceful death if she could have just, you know, stopped having these terrible, arduous treatments. And, you know, her son and one of her close friends described her final months as torture. And I think she put herself through that torture because she was unable to apply that philosophy that she had, you know, to her own life.
That kind of exceptionalism is so fascinating. Did any of the writers that you wrote about find peace and resolution in their final weeks and days?
Actually, several did. John Updike, for instance, was diagnosed with lung cancer, very devastated, you know, sort of in the, you know, really feeling strong and healthy, and then getting this diagnosis, he died very quickly. But in his final weeks, he wrote these incredible poems. And there was a moment where he was just in despair in the hospital, and he asked his wife for a sheet of scrap paper, and she pulled out, you know, a sort of mock-up of the cover of one of his books. And he began the poems that would become his incredible last cluster of poems, an endpoint about the experience of dying. And he kept writing as long as he possibly could. And those poems really gave the idea that he was still writing and still pushing himself and actually bringing news in the way that the best writing brings news is incredibly moving and was comforting. And when he finally did go to the hospice for his last day, his wife said, "Are you ready to make the leap?" And he said, "Yes." And he said it so emphatically. She was surprised by his tone because it was so loud and he was so weak. But he did seem to make peace at the end in that way. And likewise, Maurice Sendak, I write about the children's book writer, at the end of his life, he had this this dream. And he had hated snow his whole life. He was terrified of it. He would make people, like, knock the snow off his house. And he called snow white death. And he hated Christmas because he was a Jewish immigrant from Bensonhurst. He hated Christmas. So in his final week of life in the hospital, he had this dream. He could no longer hold a brush or paint or draw, but he had a dream that a woman he loved was lying on a divan in front of this great backdrop. And on the backdrop was a painted scene, and it was a painting of a snowy Christmas scene, like a Dickensian Christmas scene, this like unbelievable, beautiful painting. And he told the woman, who was the one who was on the divan, he said, "I had the most radiant dream." She said, "What was it?" And he described it. And she said, "But Maurice, you hate Christmas and you hate snow." And he was like, no, you don't understand. It was the most beautiful dream. And he had somehow managed to convert these things he was terrified of, snow and Christmas and things he hated, and make them into this beautiful, comforting dream. And I think it's the, I also love that he was sort of still painting and drawing, that his dream is a painting, because even after he was able to draw, he was still reaching for that. And somehow the mind creates its own comfort. And the imagination, like these unbelievable, glorious imaginations, are able to create this consolation at the very end.
It makes me think, since we reach for that, you know, maybe that is why we look to fiction, right? Those teary scenes in books or movies where the sedated person is somehow able to listen and the subject is somehow able to speak. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it definitely... I found it, people would say to me when I was, you know, you're writing this book on death, I would go to a cocktail party and be like, people would be like, "Oh my God, isn't that so depressing?" And it just really wasn't. It was kind of uplifting for me to write these stories because there really was something beautiful in them.
Well, Katie Roife, thank you for speaking with us about them.
Oh, thank you so much.
Katie Roife, the author of several books, most recently, The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. And a little listener recommendation here. Maurice Sendak, who is one of the writers that she profiled in the book, had a gorgeous interview toward the end of his life with Terry Gross. We'll post a link for that one, too. The final moments of real lives are rarely the stuff of great literature, but plenty has been written about that last draw of breath. From Emily Dickinson's If I Should Die to Virtually Everything by Edgar Allan Poe, mortality is a gem of a subject for writers. One of the best-known death poems by Walt Whitman isn't generally thought of as a death poem. It's O Captain, My Captain, which took on a very different meaning in the film Dead Poets Society.
O Captain, My Captain.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson.
Do you hear me? O Captain, My Captain.
O Captain, My Captain was published in 1867 in Whitman's collection Leaves of Grass. It is actually about the death of President Abraham Lincoln, which you can hear when you listen beyond the first line.
O Captain, My Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack, the prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting, while follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But O heart, 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 O the bleeding drops of red, where on the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead.
Ironically, after his death, many used the poem to pay their respects to the actor Robin Williams, posting readings on YouTube and widely sharing the famous scene from Dead Poets Society on social media, and in so doing, took the poem closer to its roots as an elegy.
Thank you, boys. Thank you.
Well, that's our final conversation for today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also listen to the show anytime on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth, NHPR, in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, you don't need to write a poem, just a quick little rating on iTunes, which will help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.